So let's take three deep breaths together, breathing in peace and breathing out joy. Peace and joy. Peace and joy. And for our opening words today, we have a selection from Desiderata by Max Ehrmann. Go placidly amidst the noise and haste, and remember what peace there may be in silence. As far as possible, without surrender, be on good terms with all persons. Enjoy your achievements as well as your plans. Keep interested in your own career, however humble. It is a real possession in the changing fortunes. Excuse me. Exercise caution in your business affairs, for the world is full of trickery. But let this not blind you to what virtue there is. Many persons strive for high ideals, and everywhere life is full of heroism. Neither be cynical about love, for in the face of all aridity and disenchantment, it is as perennial as the grass. Take kindly the counsel of years, gracefully surrendering the things of youth. Nurture strength of spirit. Beyond a wholesome discipline, be gentle with yourself. You are a child of the universe, no less than the trees or the stars. You have a right to be here. And whether or not it is clear to you, no doubt the universe is unfolding as it should. Therefore, be at peace with God, whatever you conceive him to be. And in the noisy confusion of life, keep peace with your soul. With all its charms, with all its shams, drudgery, and broken dreams, it is still a beautiful world. Be happy, be cheerful, and strive to be happy. And now we are so fortunate to have Joan Yunkin, who is a member of our congregation, to provide us with the sermon today. She planned this service, and so I welcome Joan to the altar.
Good morning. If at any time you can't hear me, just wave your order of worship or stand up or let me know somehow, please. Have you heard the news this week? The economy is still bad. Unemployment is still high, which means that families that we see every day in our own community are wondering how to make ends meet. Schools are struggling financially, so the quality of education is slipping as administrators struggle over whether to fund sports or the arts if they can't fund both. Natural disasters and weather events are claiming property and lives. Further afield, children are dying of hunger, drugs, gunshot wounds, or by their own hand. There is war and strife in the Middle East and elsewhere, people killed in the name of God, and the rich keep getting richer and the poor keep getting poorer. But wait, that's not news. The names and places change, but the stories are as old as time. And they aren't going away anytime soon. So it's with a certain degree of audacity that I raise the question, much less try to answer it in the affirmative, can we live a life of joy in today's world? And if we choose yes, what do we need to do to attract it and to keep it? First of all, what is joy? To my mind, joy and happiness are not the same thing. Joy is that deep, quiet stream in our lives. There may be bubbles of happiness on the surface, or choppy waters, or pollution in the form of addiction or unease. But under all of that, there's a river that flows steadily and easily. I think of the hymn from my early days in an evangelical church. When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to say, it is well. It is well with my soul. Do you believe, as I do, that joy is our natural state? We're born untroubled and spend much of our lives trying to get back to that place of innocence and trust, of the simplicity that we sang about in our opening hymn. Joy is that place just right. Joy is freedom from worry. We know that worry does nothing to change the future. It only robs us of the present. Joy is peace of mind, equilibrium, equanimity. Joy gives us the power to step across that fine line that separates hope, that tentative desire to witness a change, from faith, the assurance that change will indeed come. Joy is much more rare and more difficult to achieve than inertia, sadness, or indifference. Is it possible? I believe it is. Am I here to tell you how? No. We each need to uncover our own joy, but I want to share some thoughts that have helped me in that process, and perhaps they'll help you as well. Notice I haven't said anything about finding joy. Joy isn't what you find. It's what you bring with you on the search. It's the light that you carry to light your way through the dark so you can recognize the blessings when they're standing right in front of you. It's not the light at the end of the tunnel. It's the instinct that keeps us heading toward the light, even when we can't see it because it's around the bend. The opposite of joy is not sadness. It's worse than that. Just as the opposite of love is indifference, not hate, the opposite of joy is apathy, lacking the will to get out of the muck. Do you know the work of Rita Gold-Gelman? In 1987, she decided to sell all her possessions and become a citizen of the world. She has never returned to a settled life. She calls herself a modern-day nomad. She travels the world living among indigenous peoples, whether that takes her to Indonesia, Guatemala, or Manhattan. She has no permanent home and few possessions. In Tales of a Female Nomad, she writes about the first 15 years of this journey, mostly in developing countries. I learned about her by accident when I found this printed on a Starbucks coffee cup about 10 years ago. It has stuck with me and serves to keep me on the right path when I'm in danger of detouring through uncertainty, fear, disillusionment, or negative thinking. Gelman says, risk-taking, trust, and serendipity are key ingredients of joy. Without risk, nothing new ever happens. Without trust, fear creeps in. Without serendipity, there are no surprises. Without risk, nothing new ever happens. Risk can be scary. Have you experienced threshold anxiety, that surge of adrenaline that prepares us for whatever is coming? The antenna go up, the senses are sharpened. It can be pretty uncomfortable. But without it, as Gelman says, nothing new ever happens. Without embracing risk, how could we fall in love, change careers, retire, travel, speak in public? Joy can be found in all of these adventures. I think this is what Victor Hugo was talking about when he said, "Be like the bird who, pausing in her flight a while on boughs too slight, feels them give way beneath her, and yet sings, knowing she can fly. What holds us back from taking on these risks? For me, it's often the negative self-talk, bad advice from my inner critic. We get a lot of well-meaning advice from others telling us to tell our negative selves to sit down and shut up. That always seemed reasonable to me. Why subject myself to all that negative thinking? But I recently had an experience that has me thinking twice about automatically trying to shut down that voice. For the past several weeks, I've carted the seeds of this talk around in my head, scribbling notes as thoughts have occurred to me and trying to flesh them out when I get to my computer. Not long ago, I sat down late in the day when I was tired and not feeling particularly joyful, and I tried to write. Immediately, my negative self showed up and started buzzing around my head like a mosquito. I'd swatter away. Psst, going. Everything would be quiet for a while, and then she'd be back, buzzing and diving at me. "Who do you think you are, talking about how to live a life of joy? I saw you today when you forgot to go to the bank. Joyful living? Yeah, sure." Then she buzzed off for a while, but by then I was distracted and having a little trouble getting back to work and really focusing. So she saw her chance, and she was right back in there. "You know, Joan, nobody likes a Pollyanna. Look around you, woman. You're doing a real disservice if you tell anybody they should be trying to be joyful in this day and age." I kept swatting at her, telling her to go away, but finally gave up and decided to take another approach. Since she wasn't about to leave me alone, I invited her to sit down and talk with me. Instead of letting her taunt me, I gave her my full attention and I listened to her. When she tried to tell me I was stupid, had nothing to say, and couldn't say it well even if I had, I told her she was wrong and why. I reminded her of times I have done well and made worthwhile contributions. Every time she moved in on me with her claws out, I calmly told her I respect her right to have an opinion of me, but I don't happen to agree with her. I'm wiser and stronger than she gives me credit for. Where is the joy in letting her persuade me that she's the one who's right? We chatted a while, and we actually parted on good terms. I even thanked her, because standing up to her bolstered my conviction that I have something to say that's worth saying. My point is that listening to negative self-talk can be risky. It's one of those risks that Rita Goldman-Gelman talks about, but it's worth the risk. My negative self is not about to move out. If I have to live with her, we'd better learn to get along. But taking risk doesn't always guarantee that the outcome will be joy. Sometimes that negative voice takes me places I really don't want to go, and there is no joy to be found there. And which of us has not gambled and lost at some point in our life? But it's safe to say if we're fearful of taking a risk, we're not fully opening ourselves to allow joy into our lives. We can yell, "Come in," from the back of the house as long as we want, but until we unlock the door and open it, joy is still standing on the threshold waiting. Gelman says that without trust, fear creeps in. I think back on times when I've been suspicious or lacking in trust, and sure enough, fear filled the void where trust and joy could have been. I'm not suggesting we should be naive enough to ignore those gut-deep instincts that alert us when we have real reason to fear. If you have good reason to mistrust, good reason to fear, listen to that. But absent that, if trust is our default setting, we have a much better chance of living in joy. True confession, I'm not comfortable sailing. My husband has a really nice boat. And when people ask me if I go sailing with him, my perfectly honest answer is not if I can help it. But I do enjoy going out under power in the evenings. We motor down Salt Pond to the Harbor of Refuge and watch the sunset as we return to the mooring. I don't like the swells and the wakes from the other boats. They leave me clutching the rails, convinced I'm going overboard to a very certain death. One night this week when we were on the boat, I was pondering what I was going to be talking about this morning, and I wasn't paying much attention to where we were. Richard had gone out into the Harbor of Refuge, and between the running tide and the crisscross of boats crossing the entrance, we were getting tossed just a little bit. Any sailor would say it's no big deal, but I didn't like it at all. I held on for dear life. And then because I had begun to internalize some of the things I'm talking about this morning, Gelman's words just hit home. Without trust, fear creeps in. Who do I trust? I trust the designer of the boat. I'm perfectly safe. I trust Richard. He wouldn't put me at risk, or even in an uncomfortable situation. I took a deep breath, breathing in trust and breathing out fear. I felt my body relax, and I actually felt myself enjoying the gentle rise and fall of the boat as it crested the waves and slid slowly back into a state of equilibrium. It occurred to me then that fear and trust cannot occupy the same space, and I get to choose which will determine my state of mind. Gelman says that without serendipity, there are no surprises. Being in the right place at the right time, open to chance, coincidence, luck, whatever you choose to call it, can change the course of our lives and bring deep, soul-satisfying joy. My favorite high school teacher was an historian by avocation. I once asked him how he got interested in history, which to me at the time, because this is how it was being taught, meant only political and military history and the heroic deeds of great white men. He told me about his great-grandmother, who, for some reason, was not thought to be especially attractive. I don't remember if she had an unusually large nose or small ears, but it was some physical characteristic that threatened to sentence her to the life of a spinster. Then, in a chance, serendipitous encounter, along came a man who thought that nose of hers, or those ears, were just the most adorable he had ever seen. They courted, they married, their descendants now number in the many dozens, each of whom has changed the world just by virtue of their existence. Serendipity, it worked for them. Without it, I would never have had the joy of studying with Mr. Martin. 45 years later, we're still friends, and I can call him David now. Note that Gelman says key ingredients of joy, not the key ingredients. I know I can't make vegetable curry without vegetables and curry, but those are only the basic ingredients. I can top it off with peanuts or chutney or yogurt or coconut and any additional ingredients to enhance the flavors. So it is with key ingredients of joy. What more can we add? What should we add that will make our joy richer and juicier? Consider these. Pride, not boastfulness, but honest, objective pride in ourselves. Acknowledgement of our unique gifts. Satisfaction in work well done. Connections with places of quiet beauty that restore the soul. Service, joy begets joy. Connection with others, sharing life experiences. These ingredients don't guarantee that joy will come, but it's safe to say that anyone who can say they have lived a joy-filled life can point to these as having played some part in getting there. One place we may not expect to find joy is at work. It's all too often something we go to reluctantly and look forward to leaving at the end of the day. But consider this. Khalil Gibran says that work is love made visible. If he's right, what does your work say about what you love? Do you love the work itself? Do you love the paycheck or the things you can buy with it? Do you love good relationships with your colleagues? If you're lucky, you get to love the positive difference your work makes in the world. Taking risks at work can lead to joy. Many years ago, I was curator at a local historical society and was vigilant, holding my department to the highest professional standards for collections care. Controlled temperature and humidity, low light levels, white gloves, it was all about protecting the objects. So the director was taken aback when I told him I wanted to do a special tour for the Association for the Blind, to bring blind and visually impaired adults for a tour designed especially for them. I broke all the rules. There were no white gloves. Our visitors were encouraged to touch the velvets and satins and the beautiful stitching on a Victorian crazy quilt, to outline the design on a silver bowl with their fingertips, to handle antique tools and musical instruments. From over 40 years in museum work, that experience stands out as the most joyous of my career. I can't begin to describe the thrill of watching the faces of those men and women light up with pleasure, with memories, the sheer joy of being able to connect with objects of meaning that they would not otherwise have been able to touch. Did I put the collections at risk? Probably. But the choice in this instance was between sharing and not sharing, between offering an unusual experience and being overprotective, even hoarding. I'm glad I chose risk. It was so moving that I went to my office afterwards and wept. And 30 years later, I'm still moved when I remember it. That was a small-scale experience that involved only a few people. Imagine what could happen if a multi-billion-dollar corporation with 27,000 employees in 27 countries were to write a commitment to joy into its work ethic. If, for example, a power company set out to provide electricity around the world, leaving a positive environmental impact and leaving every community better than they found it. And what if they committed to experiencing joy in their life every single day they worked? The corporation AES did this with a corporate creed that echoes our own principles. Do these resonate with you? Listen. When given the opportunity to use our ability to reason, make decisions, and take responsibility for our actions, we experience joy at work. The purpose of business is not to maximize profits for shareholders, but to steward our resources to serve the world in an economically sustainable way. Fairness means treating everybody differently. Principles and values must guide all decisions. Put other stakeholders equal to or above yourself. Lead with passion, humility, and love. It can be done. We felt the tremors right here in our own community. A former principal of that company supports the South Kingstown Land Trust, the Nature Conservancy, Preserve Rhode Island, and other organizations. He donated the Edward Everett Hale House in Matunuck to the Pettaquamscutt Historical Society, along with the funds to restore it and open it to the public as a house museum and a cultural center. With these projects, he's facilitated the preservation of important places in our community while providing work opportunities for environmentalists, architects, builders, craftsmen, landscapers, suppliers, educators, artists, scholars, historians, and more. And he does it with joy. That's not something he packed up and put into storage or left behind when he retired from AES. He lives it. It can be done. Work can beget joy. If you'd like to know more about the AES story, I recommend the book Joy at Work by the former AES principal Dennis Bakke. It's a wonderful read and should be required reading for, oh, just about everybody. Once we tap into this deep river of joy in our lives, what do we do to ensure we have continued access to it? We make a conscious choice to invite it into our lives every day, a conscious choice. In times of stress or chaos, remind ourselves that under it all, joy is our natural state. Check in with yourself periodically through the day. Are you aware of that undercurrent of joy? If not, what's out of kilter? What needs to change? Pass the joy on. Joy begets joy in ourselves and in others. Use it as a tool to advance good in the world. Will it to happen. Insist on it. Assume joy as your default setting. Does all this joy blind us to the ills of the world? No. To the contrary, it prepares us to face them head on. It opens our hearts, making it possible to respond fully, knowing that sharing our own affirmations of life and hope multiplies them rather than diminishing them. Joy for the sake of joy alone is self-serving and I think probably even impossible. Personal joy, real deep joy, brings with it a need to share it, to help others rise into joy as well. Joy is not selfish and it doesn't travel alone. It brings with it hope, assurance, abundance, and generosity of spirit. You see, I'm not talking about unmitigated joy here. I don't mean we shouldn't shed a tear for the state of the world or rise up in anger in the face of injustice or abuse. Just as joy doesn't travel alone, it doesn't reside alone in our soul. Its twins are sorrow and anger, just as real, just as much a part of the human experience as joy itself. Unitarian songwriter Elizabeth Alexandra wrote one of the hymns in our teal book. We're not going to sing it today, but I want to share a couple of verses with you. She says, "As we sing of hope and joy today, some know only anguish and despair. How can we lift our voices in this way while some have pain and misery to spare? If a crumbling world we would renew, we must sing no ordinary song. Peals from a noisy gong will never do. In every breath, compassion must belong. Sing of joy while hammering each nail. Sing of hope while pulling every weed. So we shall sing together and prevail. May every alleluia bear a seed. Let every alleluia bear a seed." Whether your chosen word is work is standing arm in arm at a rally for human rights, listening quietly to someone who only needs someone to listen quietly, creating a poem or a play or a work of art that will be a catalyst for change, put your joy to work for the world, knowing in your deepest heart that a joyous life is possible, and that joy indeed begets joy. May it be so. Can we live a life of joy in today's world? I say we can, and in fact, that it's a moral imperative. I challenge you to enjoy the joy for its own sake, then to use it to help create good, to help and, let me start that sentence again. I challenge you to enjoy the joy for its own sake, then use it to help create and sustain good in our world. It's one of the best tools we have. Let every hallelujah bear a seed. May it be so. Please join hands for our closing circle.